understand about you. Beck shrugs. You were pissed off. There's a long silence as the two of us look at each other. Then she says, When I saw the footage of you online, getting mobbed by reporters outside that hotel, I knew something was going to happen. I called Solo, we went looking for you. He told me, I say. Beck's gaze drops to her lap, and she bites at her lip ring. I didn't know Vickers was going to do what he did, but I thought you might do something. Like Gabby. Yeah. I glance at the photo of Beck's sister and a lump forms in my throat. I haven't talked about why I ended up in Pineview since my first session with Dr. Ann. I swallow and look up at Beck. I already did, I say. She cocks her head. Over the summer, I chased a bottle of Xanax with a glass of my dad's favorite Irish whiskey. Why? A lot of reasons, I guess. I look up at the ceiling. I was into this guy, Derek. He was my friend, and then I made it weird, and he just cut me off. I wasn't on meds yet or in therapy or anything, and it kind of wrecked me. I didn't flush my phone, but I threw it pretty hard, smashed the screen. I show her, she nods. Anyway, I was getting ready for one of my dad's big events, like the fundraiser last week. God, was that only last week? Getting dressed up, it triggers my dysphoria. It was especially bad that night, and it snowballed into a full-on panic attack, and I felt like it would never end, like there was no other way out. Beck nods. I take a deep breath, and then I just keep talking. I tell Beck about Pineview, I tell her about Dr. Ann. When I'm done, Beck starts to speak, but stops herself. What? I ask. You never told me why you transferred. You don't want to hear that sob story. Beck raises her eyebrows. You owe me at least one, or we'll be out of balance. I smile. Fair enough. I lean back against the wall. At Immaculate Heart, I had to take PE. I don't at Park Hills. I used my dad's pull to get it waived. I glance over at Beck. Guess that makes me a hypocrite, huh? No, she says. It makes you smart. I guess. Anyway, I had to change in the locker room in front of other people. That's when I started having really bad anxiety. I couldn't eat. I lost a lot of weight. By the end of sophomore year, I was having panic attacks 2-3 times a week. Wow, Beck says. I nod. Being undressed in front of other people, it's hard. Especially on days when I don't feel like the gender I was assigned at birth, you know? Beck nods, and I wonder if she ever had this conversation with Gabby. So I started wearing my gym clothes under my school uniform every day. You can imagine the harassment. One kid asked me if I was Mormon, and I was hiding my magic underwear. Catholic kids, you know. Obsessed with sex and religion. Beck smiles. Anyway, one day, this was during the last week of sophomore year, I was changing in the locker room and 3 of my classmates came in. They said school was almost out, and before summer vacation started, they wanted to see the magic underwear. I swallow hard. It wasn't enough that I had to wear that fucking uniform every day. It wasn't enough that I changed right in front of them. They wanted to see my genitals. My voice breaks, and it's a few moments before I can go on. I refused. So 2 of them pinned me against the lockers while the other one pulled down my gym shorts so everyone could see. There were 3 other people in the locker room, but no one tried to stop it. They all just watched. One kid was about to take a picture when the coach finally came in and put a stop to it. I expect Beck to act surprised or to try to comfort me, but she doesn't, and I'm grateful. I don't want her pity right now, just her listening. And she seems to know that. At the time, I thought that was the worst thing that would ever happen to me. I watch Beck's jaw tighten. She nods. She gets it. I look out the window at the big sycamore tree just beyond the back fence. The branches are swaying in the strong autumn wind, leaves detaching like skydivers jumping out of a plane. I thought if I changed schools, things would be better. I thought I could get away from people like that. I turned back to Beck. But there are people like that everywhere. Just like there are people like me everywhere. Like Andy Gingham, like your sister. Beck's eyes drift to Gabby's photo. She shifts on the bed, runs a hand over her scalp. I glance up at the shredded rainbow sticker on the closet door. I want to tell Beck everything that's happened to me. Being stalked online, having my locker vandalized, coming out to my parents. And if I could tell anyone about what happened that night, how they held me down, how his stubble felt against my cheek, I would tell Beck. But now isn't the time. Right now, I just want her back. Us back. Riley, Beck says. I look up at her. I'm sorry I didn't stay at the hospital. I'm sorry I left, I just... No, I say, you don't have to apologize. I didn't mean what I said earlier about you running away. You were there when it counted. For a moment, I think Beck is going to cry, but she doesn't. She just takes my hand. My parents are in the kitchen waiting for me when I get home. Mom rushes across the room to embrace me. Oh my God, Riley, we were so worried. She steps back, holding me at arm's length. Her hair is a tangled mess and her eyes are puffy. Don't you ever do that again, you understand me? I'm sorry, Mom, I won't. I glance at Dad, expecting to see his face red with anger, but he looks calm. I needed to see Beck, and I didn't want to talk to you about it first. Dad walks over and puts an arm on Mom's shoulder. Well, now I think it's time we did talk. Mom makes tea, and we sit around the kitchen table with her in the middle, gripping both our hands as though she's afraid the house might tip over and sink. Dad looks at me. You want to start? Okay, I say. But then I just stare at the table, trying to think of what to say. Finally, I speak up. I don't know what you think about me. Mom inhales sharply and grips my hand even tighter. We love you, you know we love you. I know, I say, but that's not what I meant. She glances at my dad. He looks intensely uncomfortable and does his habitual throat clearing before he speaks up. Well, he says, we've only had a few days to process all this, and obviously the circumstances weren't ideal when you told us. I know, I say. Dad continues. And so much has happened since, we really haven't had time to deal with your gender identity stuff. His mouth tightens into a thin line. Okay, I say, but you have to have some reaction, right? Dad blinks, then looks pleadingly at my mother. Well, honey, she says, this is all very new to us. I mean, we understand gay and straight, and we know there are transgender people, but until you said it out loud, neither of us had heard of gender fluid. She glances at him. We had to look it up. Dad grips his mug. Honestly, there's so much information out there, and a lot of it contradicts itself. The pronouns and the terminology, it's very complex, and... Mom cuts in. But we love you no matter what, Riley. You're our child. Dad looks at her, and then he nods. Her mother's right. His eyes meet mine and he says, but you're going to have to help us navigate this whole thing. We're old and set in our bipolar ways. Binary, Dad, I say. He nods. Right. Binary. And then Mom sort of lunges forward and engulfs me in an awkward, suffocating hug. And after a moment, I hug her back. I expect my shoulders to start shaking, my eyes to start gushing tears, to have some profound catharsis, but apparently I'm cried out for the night. Finally, we release each other. Dad gives me a thin smile. I say, I think I'm ready to talk to the police now. Dad raises his eyebrows. Are you sure? Yeah, I say. But will you stay with me while I call? Of course we will. He says. The line connects on the third ring, and a man's voice asks whom I'd like to be connected with. I say, Officer Dinning, please. Chapter 33. This is the part where I don't ask how you're feeling, Dr. Anne says, taking her usual seat. And this is the part where I tell you I don't know. She makes an uncharacteristic throwaway gesture with one hand. Make something up. I frown. Is this some new tactic to get me talking? Make something up, you mean lie? Dr. Anne glances at her watch. Well, it's a 50-minute session. If you're not going to talk about your feelings, you've got to say something. I blink at her. Something. Dr. Anne laughs, and then I do too. It's the first time I've laughed without crying since the assault. It's the first time I've ever thought of it as the assault. Today is Thursday. It's been over a week. What's going on over there? Dr. Anne asks. I fold my arms in front of my chest and look down at my feet. I know it's a defensive posture, but I need a little defense right now. They arrested Jim Vickers, I say. Dr. Anne raises her eyebrows. When? Yesterday. She leans back in her chair. So you spoke to the police? I nod. Tuesday night. I didn't want to go to the station, but with the reporters still camped outside my house, we couldn't exactly have cop cars showing up. So the officers took one of their personal cars and came in regular clothes in the middle of the night. That was very accommodating of them, Dr. Anne says. Congressman Perk, I say. Are you relieved? A little. Not as much as I expected to be. I get that, she says. We look at each other for a moment, and I get the feeling she really does get it. Like maybe she's been through something similar. But before I can ask, she goes on. So you told them what happened, and they arrested him? Not exactly. They said they'd question him, but they needed more than just my word to actually drag him away in handcuffs. They must have gotten something, though, because my dad made some calls this morning and found out he was in custody. My guess is one of his accomplices finally told the truth. Cole, maybe. Or the redheaded kid, Grady. I don't know. I answered all the cops' questions, but they've been super reluctant to tell me anything. Dr. Anne shakes her head. When the people involved are minors, they can't, even when they want to. I know, they explained it to me about 9 times. And what they did tell me was only after my dad leaned on them. Did you find out anything about your stalker? Yes and no. What do you mean? Well, after Vickers did what he did, I just assumed it had been him all along. Dr. Anne nods. I would have too. But they checked all his stuff, his phone, his laptop, and they didn't find any evidence. So it's possible he was sending me those messages from a friend's computer or from the library or something, but it could be somebody else entirely. They're still looking. She nods. Are you angry? Are you disappointed? I look at Dr. Anne, amazed that she can read me so well. Both, I think. The thing is, if Vickers wasn't the one sending those messages, it means he's in less trouble. Because stalking is a separate charge, and it would have helped prove that he was thinking about the assault beforehand. I almost don't say the word, and when I do, it sounds like gibberish to me. Do you ever find yourself asking why? I frown. Why what? Why someone stalked me? Why Vickers did what he did? She nods. Either. Both. I don't know. The cops told me Vickers' dad is a minister at a pretty intense church, so maybe it has to do with that. Or maybe he was just getting back at me for breaking his arm and he was drunk and it went too far. I sniff, suddenly aware my nose is running. Dr. Anne hands me a tissue. I wipe my nose and look up at her. I don't know. I don't know if I want to know or if it even matters. Dr. Anne looks like she's about to argue, maybe to correct something I've just said, but I interrupt her. Can I get some water? Of course, she says, and crosses to the cooler on the other side of the office. After a moment, she returns with a little plastic cup. I take a sip, and the cool water feels good on my throat. They're talking about this being a hate crime, I say. It's kind of surreal, like something from the news. Yeah, Dr. Anne says. I bet it feels strange. Scylla said they went all CSI on my locker. But again, the police wouldn't tell us anything, even when my dad gave them his righteous elected official act, because they're protecting the identity of minors, which is pretty ironic. And frustrating. Yeah. So, anyway, the first part of the interview was okay, but then it got hard. What was hard about it? Giving my statements. They wanted to record me talking about the assault. Is there anything about that you want to share? I shake my head. We've already been through all that, and it'll just make me a mess. That's fair, she says. We look at each other for a moment, almost like opponents in a chess game. Then Dr. Ann says, How's the anxiety been? And just like that, we've moved on. It's leveled out some, I say, but it doesn't really go away. Like there's this constant buzz in the background. My face pretty much starts tingling when I wake up and doesn't really stop until I go to sleep. Maybe it keeps tingling while I'm asleep, I don't know. What else? Bright lights bother me. Beck bought me these yellow sunglasses to wear indoors. She says they make me look like Bono. Now Dr. Ann does take the pad from her desk. She makes a note and then sits back down. I'm going to adjust your meds. Before I can protest, she gives me a stern look. Just slightly and temporarily. You need the relief. When you crank up my dosage, I feel foggy. You taking the bar exam or something? She puts down the pad. Let's try foggy for a month instead of buzzing, just for a change, okay? Okay. How are you doing with your mom and dad? We talked. Not about what happened that night. I mean, they were there when the police interviewed me, but we talked about me. About being gender fluid. I pause, but Dr. Ann doesn't say anything, so I go on. Dad's being cool about it, but I think he might not believe it's a real thing. Or maybe he thinks it's just a phase and I'm going to grow out of it. Does that bother you? I shrug. I mean, he's a Catholic congressman. It might take him a while to wrap his brain around having a gender-fluid kid. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. At this, Dr. Ann smiles, but she recovers her clinical expression quickly. Have you talked about his campaign? Yeah. He says he doesn't blame me, but I think he does a little. But I think he forgives me, too. I stare down at the abstract pattern in the carpet. I didn't know it was possible to blame someone and forgive them at the same time. But I think it is. And how about your mom? I think my mom accepts it without really understanding it. After we talked, I got the feeling she's just relieved it's out in the open. But I don't know. I run my finger back and forth over one of the chair's brass buttons. The texture is soothing. I think she's disappointed. Mom likes to plan things, to pick out the colors and the flowers and the clothes. I think the idea that she can't take me shopping for a tux or a prom dress leaves her feeling kind of cheated. You could let her take you shopping for both, Dr. Ann says. I look up at her. You know, as utterly unbearable as that sounds, I think she would love it. Dr. Ann waves a hand. No charge. I laugh. That's the second time. She gives me a faint smile. Have you thought about when you might go back to school? I nod. Tomorrow. She raises her eyebrows. You feel ready for that? No, I'm tingling head to toe just thinking about it. But despite my nerves, my voice sounds clear, calm. It surprises me. But I can't hide forever. Another week isn't forever. I know. But I've already wasted so much time hiding. And I feel like the longer I wait, the harder it will be to go back, you know? Dr. Ann sits back in her chair and lets out a long, uncharacteristically dramatic sigh. Well, she says, you don't need my approval. I frown. I know, but I sort of want it. She inhales through her nose and shakes her head. Riley, I don't know what to say. You've been through a lot. I'd hate to see you push yourself too hard and have a setback. But everyone heals in different ways and at different speeds. And if you feel compelled from the inside, not by someone else, then I think you should do it. A shudder of relief runs through me. Thanks, I say. Do you have a plan for how to get through the day? Half a day, I say. But yeah, I have a plan. Why half a day? I smile. I have a feeling I'm going off campus for lunch. Chapter 34. School sort of sucked without you, Solo says as we pull onto Imperial Highway. It's Friday morning, 10 days after the assault, and I'm more than a little nervous about returning. I smile at him. I almost say, "That's sweet," but it feels too girly. So instead, I just say, "Right on," in a terrible Matthew McConaughey voice. Solo gives me an odd look like I've just said something in Klingon. Apparently, I overshot "not girly" and landed in awkward. I guess some things don't change. I make a mental note to blog about it. "So I got a text this morning," Solo says. "Apparently the police showed up at Sierra Wells' house last night." I whirl to face him. "Why, to question her about Vickers?" "That was my first guess, too. But word has it she's the one who trashed your locker." I gape at him. "What?" "Yeah," he says. "Some freshman said they saw her trying to jimmy the lock while everyone was in class." I stare blankly out the windshield, stunned. I picture the letters pasted in my locker. Poor little Riley. I put a hand to my mouth. "Oh, God." Solo turns to look at me. "Sierra." "What about her?" I don't reply. It takes me a moment to process it all. When Vickers found out about my blog, of course he would have showed it to his girlfriend. I recall that first anonymous hate message. Not, "You're a fag." That didn't have the same threatening undertone as the others. No, the first one that hit me hard was, "Go back to where you came from, Dyke. Our school doesn't need another faggot." I try to remember when I received it. Only a day. Or maybe 2 days after I embarrassed Sierra in front of her friends with my "you're really not my type" comment. Did she send that first message as payback? Then the Andy Gingham story broke and I got "see you at lunch, fucking tranny." That must have been her too. And after I emasculated her boyfriend by breaking his arm at the football game, she wrote "poor little Riley." The same message the vandal had pasted inside my locker. If Sierra did the locker, then she sent the messages too. "Riley," Solo says, snapping me out of my trance. "What's going on?" "Someone was stalking me on my blog," I say, only half aware of the words coming out of my mouth. "What?" Solo says. And then, as quickly as I can, I fill him in on the whole story, from the first anonymous hate mail to the final message pasted in my locker. When I'm finished, I sink back into the seat, stunned, and more than a little scared. "Oh, shit," I say. "I don't get it. Aren't you happy she's at least being questioned?" "I am. But if what she did to my locker was payback for humiliating her boyfriend, what will she do when she finds out I got him arrested?" "I wouldn't worry about that," Solo says. His voice is low, almost a growl. "What does that mean?" "It means me and the rest of the guys on the team have your back. Anybody tries to fuck with you, they'll wish they were safe in prison." I gape at Solo at the sudden ferocity in his eyes. He glances over at me. "What?" "I've just never seen you go all Papa Bear like that. It's kind of hot." Solo's cheeks redden and he adjusts his grip on the steering wheel. He signals for a turn and the hatchback shudders as he shifts into a low gear to climb the hill towards school. "So what are people saying?" "Oh, there's the usual vomit of prejudiced nonsense," he says, covering. "Most people are just confused or ignorant. Or both. Some of the results are funny, actually." "Funny?" "For example, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes got together and made temporary tattoos of that verse from Leviticus. You know, man shall not lay within 4 cubits of another penis lest he be smitten or whatever. They handed them out at lunch like black armbands. And then in response, the theater gang made these stickers that said Leviticus 1928 and plastered them all over the school." "What's Leviticus 1928? "It's the verse that forbids tattoos." I laugh. Solo continues. "So the bad news is most people are grossly misinterpreting what's going on. But the good news is that there's open conversation about it." We pull into a parking space at the far end of the lot and Solo shuts off the car. "So," he says, drumming his fingers idly on the steering wheel, "Beck's meeting us before?" "Yeah." "You're sure you want to do this?" I glance up at the concrete walls of Park Hills High School and let out a long breath. "I'm sure." Everyone looks up from their desks as Solo and I walk into AP English 5 minutes late. I stop, frozen in the moment as the door hisses shut behind me on its pneumatic hinge. I've been absent from school for over a week, and during that time my story has dominated the news. Of course they're looking. My heart gives one frantic thump in my throat, and then settles into an elevated but steady rhythm as I move toward my desk. I glance at Sierra's usual desk. It's empty. And breathe a sigh of relief before moving down the aisle toward my own. When I've taken my seat, I look over at Solo for moral support. He obliges by rolling his eyes into the back of his head and giving me the finger. I grin in spite of myself. Miss Crane continues her lesson, taking our entrance in stride. But when I sit down, I catch her looking at me. She smiles, but it's a sad smile, and I'm surprised to see not pity, but genuine understanding in her eyes. I wonder what she's been through. She then proceeds to set the world record for dropping the most Harry Potter references in a 50-minute period. As I'm reaching for the door of Mr. Hibbard's room, a voice from behind stops me. Riley, wait up. I turn around and my jaw drops. It's Casey Reese, but it's not the pretty, long-haired girl I know from French. This Casey Reese has short, dyed brown hair parted neatly on the side. He, I think, is wearing a bow tie and looks like something out of a Banana Republic ad, but the eyes and the voice are unmistakably Casey's. Holy, I say, clapping my hand to my mouth. Casey's face splits into a wide, bright grin. Surprised? I'm sorry, that was so rude. It took me a minute to... You look fantastic. Thanks. Casey's smile dissolves into a more serious expression. I heard what happened. I mean, everybody heard, but... He shakes his head. Sorry, this isn't going well. Let's start over. He puts out his hand. Hi, I'm Casey. I smile and shake it. Riley. Well, Riley, Casey says, I'm a boy, and you gave me the courage to say that out loud. I blink. My mouth has gone dry. You don't have to say anything, Casey says. I just wanted you to know that I wouldn't have come out if it weren't for you. So thank you. I glance around the hall. Two girls stare at us as they walk by. I don't even react. I look back at Casey. Are they giving you hell? I ask. He shrugs. Not so much. I mean, yeah, but so what? I am who I am, you know, and it feels good not to hide it anymore. I nod. I guess I haven't really gotten to that part yet. Just then the bell rings. Casey opens his mouth like he's going to say something else, something important, but instead he just smiles. See you in French? He asks. Absolutely, I say. And then I watch as Casey turns and walks off to class. Struts, really. His confidence is magnetic. I feel a swell of pride and envy. When the bell rings, I turn away from Mr. Hibbard's room. I find a secluded spot in the back stairwell, pull out my phone, and place a call. Hi, Mike Michelle? It's Riley. After French, Solo picks me up outside Madame Bordelon's room. He's insisted on being my bodyguard as we cross the campus to meet Beck. I'm grateful, because the anxious buzzing in my head has been getting progressively worse all morning, and having him around helps. As we're passing the lockers, we turn the corner and I spot a short brunette girl walking toward us. She looks up and I recognize her at once. It's Sierra Wells. I stop and she does too. We stand there for a long moment, staring dumbly at each other. The buzzing in my head gets louder, my chest goes tight. Solo puts a protective hand on my shoulder. Sierra looks from me to Solo and then back again, like she's sizing us up for a fight. And I'm caught completely by surprise when she actually speaks. I didn't have anything to do with what Jimmy did, she says, her tone daring me to argue. At first, I'm too stunned to respond, and then Solo takes a step forward. You did plenty, he says. You should be in jail. I surprise myself by reaching out to touch his arm with my tingling fingertips. It's okay, Solo, I say. He looks at me, concerned, and I give him a reassuring nod. He takes a step back, and I turn to face Sierra. Her expression is hard, not angry, but closed off, withdrawn. Whatever vulnerability still exists in her, I got my last look at it that day in Miss Crane's classroom when I walked in on her crying. Now her shield is up, and I doubt if any of my words will get through. But what I have to say isn't for her anyway. It's for me. I swallow and fight to keep my voice even. I'm not going to stop being who I am just because you don't like it. Sierra glances around uncomfortably, as if she doesn't want to be seen having a conversation with me. I clear my throat, Congressman Kavanaugh style, and she turns her attention to me again. And I'm not going to stop talking about it just because you don't understand it. Knees shaking, I take a small step toward her. I'm only going to talk louder. I raise my voice on this last word, and Sierra glares at me. Just when I think she's about to retort, her bottom lip quivers and her face softens. She looks down at her feet and whispers something. It could be, I'm sorry, but her voice is too quiet to be sure. And then, she hitches her bag up on her shoulder and walks away. As soon as she turns the corner, I have to steady myself by grabbing Solo's massive arm. You okay? He says. I will be, I reply. Beck is waiting for us behind the language arts wing, and when I see her, I throw my arms around her and bury my face in her neck. The collar of her denim jacket is rough and real against my cheek. What happened? She asks. Beck holds my hand while Solo fills her in on the encounter with Sierra. You know, Beck says, shaking her head, all this time I thought it was me, but it turns out you're the one. You're the one who has it. I frown. Has what? The overdeveloped sense of drama. I smile. Put your glasses back on, Bono, Beck says. We have an entrance to make. My heart rate seems to accelerate with every step we take toward the cafeteria. And by the time we're standing at the top of the stairs, the blood is pounding in my ears and my vision has gone full tunnel. Are you all right? Beck asks. No, I say, breathing in shallow gasps. I'm having a full-on panic attack. Should we go back? I shake my head. No. We walk all the way through, no matter what. Beck looks at Solo, then back at me. Okay, she says. And something seems to snap inside me, like a spell breaking. Like that feeling when your ears pop as the plane is landing, and suddenly you can hear again. I blink. The tunnel vision is gone. My heart is beating 1,000 times a second, my breath still coming in shallow gulps, but I don't care. I take one step, then another, then another. And then we're in the gauntlet, all three of us walking right down the center of the aisle. I glance over at a table full of kids eating while they study, and make eye contact with a tall, skinny guy in a red t-shirt. He smiles and nods, but there's no special recognition in it. He's just being polite. We pass the band kids, but no one looks up. As we approach the football table, someone calls out to Solo. He waves in response. Vickers isn't here, he's still in custody, and there's no sign of Sierra either, or Cole, or any of that crew. I stop in the dead center of the cafeteria and look around. Some heads turn in my direction, and maybe 6 people lean over and whisper to their friends. One guy looks at me and shakes his head in disgust, then goes back to eating. A group of cheerleaders breaks out in a chorus of giggles that I'm pretty sure is because of me. But for the most part, nothing happens. A hush does not fall over the crowd. No one yells faggot or dyke or throws food. On the other hand, no one shouts my name in triumph either. There is no slow golf clap building up to a standing ovation. It's just a bunch of people eating lunch. I laugh out loud, and Beck turns to look at me, her face drawn with concern. You all right? She asks. Yeah, I say. I was just thinking, if I have to eat one more dry-ass cafeteria burrito, I might have a complete nervous breakdown. Beck nods. So on the veg? Definitely. And before I know it, we're out of the cafeteria and scrambling down the slope to the parking lot. I need meat, Solo says. Let's go to the Reagan years. You want me to fall into a dairy-induced coma, I reply. You like their fries. A teen of indeterminate gender cannot live by fries alone. Wait, Solo says. So we can joke about this now? I shake my head. I can joke about this. You must remain neutral and respectful at all times. Beck snorts. That's totally unfair, Solo says. You're a rich white kid. Why can't I make fun of you? I don't make the rules, Solo. I just represent. I pound my chest with a fist. Solo laughs. So be it. Chapter 35. Dad comes home early, citing a long day of campaigning ahead of him tomorrow. He looks absolutely beat. My mom, who took the day off to go event hopping with him, looks pretty wiped out herself. I know she's tired when she announces that Chelly will be dropping off Thai food at 6. Dinner conversation is light, and I only pick at my vegetable pad sayu. I'm too amped to eat. Finally, I push the styrofoam container away. Mom, Dad, they look up at me. I take a deep breath. There's something I want to do, but it's kind of big, and I don't want to do it unless you're okay with it. They exchange interested looks. All right, Dad says, tell us. So I do. I tell them about Mike Michelle's invitation to speak on the panel at Trans HealthCon tomorrow, and how Casey's coming out today inspired me to do more than just blog about what I've been through. When I'm done, Dad loosens his tie and clears his throat. Riley, he says, I don't know about this. You'd be obliterating your privacy. I meet his eye. Dad, I've spent the last week holed up in my room, avoiding the TV, hardly even going on the internet. We've disconnected our home phone. Reporters stake out the house. You have to sneak out through the side yard and get picked up in a rental car. Our privacy is sort of over. He exchanges a dark look with my mom. I continue before they can interrupt. You always say the best leaders figure out how to turn a bad situation to their advantage. When life gives you gators, you make Gatorade. Remember? I watch his face for some sign, and after a moment I swear he's trying to suppress a smile. I think I may have won him over. My mom's face, on the other hand, is tight with concern, so I turn my attention to her. I feel like if I can talk about it, about coming out and my situation, maybe it will help me process all of this, and give it a positive meaning instead of just being a sad story about something that happened to me. Mom lets out a long sigh, reaches up like she's going to chew her cuticle, then folds her hands. I go on. I think about what Beck will say if I just hide from all of this. And my friends at the queue. Andy Gingham, Casey Reese, the 50,000 people who follow my blog. Dad says, I know you feel accountable to your community, and that's admirable, but you don't owe it to them. You don't owe it to anyone. I look up at him. I owe it to me. Finally, Mom speaks, her voice heavy with worry. It's just so soon. I shake my head. The timing is right. The election, the assault, it's all still in the news. I have this little window of time when I can talk into a big microphone. This is my chance to speak up for other people like me. Mom looks up at me. Her eyes are getting moist. Dad puts his hand on hers and says, Sharon, what do you think? She shakes her head. You are your father's child, Riley. On Saturday morning, the day of the conference, I stand in front of my closet, staring at the palette of faded black and blue clothes hanging inside. The only brightly colored thing in here is a yellow t-shirt I've never worn, crammed way in the back. For the first time, I understand what my mother has been complaining about since I was a kid. My wardrobe has all the color of a week-old bruise. Mom is sitting on the couch in the living room reading one of her guilty pleasures, a bodice-ripper romance novel. When I enter the room, she looks up from her book, embarrassed, like a kid caught watching an R-rated movie. You startled me, she says, closing her book. Is everything okay? Yeah, I say, everything's good. I was wondering if you'd take me shopping? I've never seen my mother get into a car so quickly in my life. When we walk out of Nordstrom 2 hours later, both of us are smiling like we've won the lottery. The outfit I end up with is, as my mother put it, very me. A simple white dress shirt with a blue tie, darker than my dad's cornflower blue, but not by much. Below that, I chose a dark green tartan fabric with thin blue lines running through the plaid. It hangs just above the knee and lands somewhere in the middle of the skirt-kilt continuum. On my feet, a brand new pair of blue 16-hole Doc Martens. The outfit is part punk rock, part Catholic schoolgirl, part prep school lacrosse guy. I love it. I absolutely adore it. I want to marry it and make babies with it. Solo and Beck are late picking me up for the conference. I couldn't find Bullethead, Solo says. You've been there, Beck says, and it's bullet hole. Solo throws up his hands. Well, that's why. I was looking for a sign with a head on it. The sign does not have a head on it, you nincompoop. A head with a bullet hole in it. Solo frowns. Did you just use the word nincompoop? I'm reviving the Dickensian insult movement. There is no Dickensian insult movement. Then I'm starting one. Hey, guys, I say, I hate to interrupt, but Beck, could you please let me ride shotgun? I don't want to puke in the solo mobile. My stomach is already churning at the thought of walking into the conference. And truth be told, the tingling from this morning hasn't really gone away. On top of that, despite my upped dosage, the buzzing in the back of my head keeps getting louder. In short, I'm a wreck. Solo reaches across Beck's lap to unlock her door. He fixes her with a triumphant glare.
Begone, thou scruffy-looking nerf herder.
Beck gives him a sour look. That's not even... Who are you? Carefully, she opens the battered car door. She's evened out her choppy hair into a smooth buzz cut that actually looks good on her. She's got her jean jacket on over a t-shirt that features a glittery prancing unicorn. I'm not sure if she's wearing it out of a sense of irony or if it's her attempt to balance out her new hairdo with something more feminine. When she gets out of the car, she glances at me and then does a double take. Wow, she says. You look extremely hot. I blush with the fire of a thousand suns. The parking lot is packed when we arrive a few minutes past 2 o'clock, so Solo drops us off in front and says he'll meet us inside. Beck and I turn our faces down against the strong autumn wind and walk side by side toward the entrance. The convention center is a massive, looming glass structure the size of a football stadium. The closer we get to the front doors, the shallower my breath becomes. I can't stop imagining all the people inside. All those eyes looking at me. The tingling in my hands spreads up my arms. I take deep Dr. Anne breaths. I have to fight this. I need to be at my best today. It's important. But the breaths don't help. The tingling radiates through my body and tunnel vision starts to close in. I'm losing control. My feet go numb. I catch my toe on a seam in the concrete and stumble. Beck catches me before I can fall, grabbing me by the shoulders with surprising strength, holding me steady. She leads me toward a ring of trees off to one side. There's a green metal bench in the center. My heart is pounding in my chest, my vision blurred. Beck doesn't ask if I'm okay. She doesn't tell me there's nothing to be afraid of. She just guides me to the bench, puts a hand on my back, and says, breathe. She takes my hands in hers and looks into my eyes, but I can't seem to focus on her. The wind picks up and parts the canopy of leaves overhead. For a split second, the sun peeks through, flashing in my eyes, bright and angry. Like a camera flash. Like a sodium lamp. Like the headlight of a truck. And all at once, I'm there again. I feel their hands holding me down, feel the pressure against my back. Somewhere in the distance, Beck's voice says, stay with me. But I can't. I can't stay. I have to go. I withdraw. My face is numb. My face is numb. The world shrinks to a pinprick. Far away, I feel Beck grip my shoulders. She pulls me into her arms. I feel her hands on my back holding me, and I start to thrash, but she only hugs me tighter. I struggle for a moment, but when I know she isn't going to let go, I stop. I feel my body go slack. She holds me, not forcing, containing, stilling. My heartbeat slows. My breathing becomes more even. My face is pressed against Beck's shoulder. It's wet. After a long time, she pulls away and looks at me. Her face slowly comes into focus. Elfin ears, high cheekbones, strong nose, and those eyes. Those lightsaber blue eyes. She takes my hand again, brushes the tips of my fingers with her own. The tingling is gone. I feel a sensation in my stomach, not the uncomfortable twisting from before, but the fluttering of butterfly wings. Beck's face is strong, set, There's concern in her eyes, but no panic. The butterflies in my stomach rise. I lean closer. My eyes drift down to her mouth. Her thin lips set in a straight line. The metal ring in her lower lip twitches. Riley, it's too soon. It's okay, I whisper. And I lean in. I'm only an inch away when she stops me with a hand on my chest, and I feel my heart dive into my stomach. Beck sees the expression on my face and shakes her head. It's not like that, she says. Shame and confusion well up inside me. I'm not stopping you because I don't want us to kiss, she says. I want to reply, but no words come. I'm stopping you because I want it to be like this. She takes my hand, places it over her heart. Hers is beating fast, too, and I can feel her breath quicken at my touch. And then she smiles that crooked half-smile, grips my shirt in her fist, and pulls me into a kiss. Her lips are firm. The metal of her lip ring feels cold and solid against my skin. She puts her hand on the side of my face, brushing her thumb across my cheek. A swirling dizziness replaces the tingling in my head, then spreads through the rest of me. And then, it's as if a bank of stadium lights comes on behind my eyelids, but it's a good brightness, a warm brightness, and I don't flinch from it. There's a soft sound, and our lips come apart. Beck leans her forehead against mine. I've been wanting to do that for a long time, she says. I keep my eyes closed. I don't want that brightness to go away. I thought you liked the scruffy lumberjack type, like your drummer. Beck laughs. Don't be stupid. I don't have a type. I have standards. I open my eyes and look into hers. And I meet them? You are them. I start to reply, but she puts a finger to my lips. We can talk about all this later. Right now, your public awaits. Chapter 36. Mike, Michelle, and Canada are waiting for us outside the conference hall. Canada actually lifts me off my feet when she embraces me, and Mike, Michelle follows with a more subdued hug. Solo and Beck wish me good luck, then head in to find seats. When the door is closed behind them, Mike, Michelle turns to me, her expression serious. Riley, listen, Don't worry about me, I interrupt. I'm okay. I'm ready. I don't doubt you for a moment, she says, but you need to know that the room is packed with reporters and photographers. I know, I say. I invited them. Mike, Michelle frowns. For a moment, I think she's going to be angry, but then she says, you couldn't possibly have called every news station in the greater Los Angeles area all by yourself. I shrug. Didn't have to. I figured they'd all be checking my blog, so I just posted the time and the address. Canada throws back her head and laughs. My, my, she says. Somebody just out-Mike Michelle'd Mike Michelle. I smile. Sorry for the surprise. Don't apologize, Mike Michelle says. We'll take all the attention we can get. Her smile falters, and she grips my arm gently. I'll do my best to keep it civilized in there, but once the Q&A starts, I won't be able to control them. I remember the storm of reporters outside the hotel last week. Was it only last week? The cameras flashing, the din of raised voices, the press of arms and elbows, the microphones being thrust at me as I tried to push my way through. I feel my heart beat in my throat again. I look from Canada to Mike Michelle. And then I walk to the doors and push them open. I'm staring into the biggest conference hall I've ever seen in my life. You could park a 747 in here. And yet a claustrophobic dread settles in on me as 500 people turn in their seats like attendees at a celebrity wedding. There's a pause as reporters and conference goers alike try to identify me. Finally, someone yells, Alex! And then the flashes start going off. Canada takes me by one arm, Mike Michelle by the other. Reporters call out questions as we make our way down the aisle. But there are legitimate attendees in the crowd, too, shouting encouragement. I spot one conference goer with dyed green hair holding up a sign that reads, We love you, Alex. Another throws a lei of plastic flowers in my direction as I walk past. The whole gang from the queue is here. Even Morgan, who's still wearing that same green flight jacket. I spot Casey Reese, too, standing just across the aisle. He makes a point of gesturing to his hair, which he's spiked into a faux hawk, and gives me two thumbs up. I smile at him. Beck and Solo are seated about 5 rows from the front. Beck waves, but Solo looks concerned, half standing as though he might plunge into the aisle and start clearing the crowd. But Beck pulls him back into his seat. There's a stage at the front of the room with a long banquet table and a lectern packed with microphones. I take my place between the two panelists already seated at the table, a tall man in a loud green shirt and an older woman with a wispy gray ponytail. Canada finds a seat in the front row, and Mike Michelle takes the podium. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Building LGBTQ Communities Online. Today, we're going to explore... But she's interrupted as the first reporters sound off.
Riley, how do you think your coming out will affect your father's campaign? Do you feel responsible for the...
Mike Michelle pounds a fist on the lectern, and it booms through the sound system with a squeal of feedback. Folks, this is a panel, not a press conference. I would ask you to kindly hold your questions until the end. As the panel goes on, I struggle to keep my breathing under control. Every time a flash goes off, I jump a little in my chair. I wish I'd thought to ask Dr. Ann for an extra Xanax. Mike Michelle mediates, and I'm grateful that she poses most of the questions to the other two panelists. The man in the neon shirt is a professional lobbyist, and the older woman runs the biggest gay and lesbian newsletter in the United States. I field a few of the questions, trying to answer as best I can, but I feel like a child next to these two older, more qualified experts. But eventually, my turn comes. How did you approach building your own online community? Mike Michelle asks, and looks at me as if I have some kind of expertise to offer. It sort of happened by accident, I say. I'm totally serious, but it gets a big laugh, reminding me vaguely of my gymnastics scholarship moment at Dad's fundraiser. My doctor told me to start an anonymous blog as part of therapy. And then the Andy Gingham story broke, so mostly it was out of my hands. I guess I just tried to be real and give the advice I'd want someone to give me. Mike Michelle gives me a tender smile, and then the other two panelists cut in with a bunch of jargon about SEO and other things I don't really understand. With about 10 minutes left, I'm watching the clock on my phone, counting down the minutes. Mike Michelle steers the conversation off topic. She looks down at her cards, seems to consider, and then sets them aside and looks at me. What would you say to someone who claims that non-binary gender identities aren't real? What do you think of people who say, man or woman, that's all there is, pick one? I glance into the audience. A few flashes go off. I don't know, I say. People are complicated and messy. Seems too convenient that we'd all fit inside some multiple-choice question. Finally, Mike Michelle invites us to make our closing statements. The newsletter woman goes first, then the lobbyist in the neon shirt, and then it's my turn. Hands shaking, I unfold a printout of something I wrote late last night. I shouldn't be so nervous, it's basically a blog post, but the thought of reading it out loud makes my face tingle. As I read it, I avoid making eye contact, and I stumble over my words quite a bit. But I think it comes off okay. I wish I had some all-encompassing wisdom to give you, or to give myself, you know? Because I've been through a lot, and it hurts. I want everything I've been through to make sense. I want the pain to have meaning. I want it to change something. I look out into the crowd and find Beck. Her eyes are wide and serious, and she never takes them off me. But the truth is, feelings don't change anything. To change something, you have to say things out loud. Do things. Take chances. Take a stand. I pause, and when I clear my throat, it echoes through the PA. So this is the stand I'm taking. I'm not going to hide anymore. The room goes quiet for a second, and then the crowd starts to applaud. I have to wipe at my eyes with my sleeve. When Mike Michelle finally opens the panel to questions from the audience, the room explodes in cacophony. The media, who have managed to keep their silence for the last 30 minutes, all start yelling questions at once. Mike Michelle pounds on the lectern like a courtroom judge, but they ignore her. In the midst of all the shouting, one of the doors in the back hall opens partway, and a man slips in. He's tall and wears a blue baseball cap over dark aviator sunglasses. Avoiding the center aisle, he makes his way down the side of the big room and finds an empty seat at the end of the sixth or seventh row. I look closer and see that there's gold writing on his blue cap. It's the University of Notre Dame logo. It's my dad. My heart swells in my chest, and I can't stop tears from leaking down the sides of my face. I wipe them away quickly and smile at him. He nods in reply. Then he sinks down into his chair to disguise his height. I glance around to see if anyone else noticed his arrival, but if they have, they don't appear to recognize him. Mike Michelle walks over to my chair and leans down to talk in my ear. We should just end it now and escort you out of here. The Q&A is a joke. They're not going to stop yelling. I shake my head. Let me talk to them. To my surprise, Mike Michelle nods and steps aside. I stand up and make my way to the podium. At first, the noise swells, and a fireworks show of flashes pops across my vision. I hold up my hand to shield my eyes. Hey, I say into a cluster of microphones. Hey, can everybody quiet down? Slowly, the din of shouting ebbs. I glance at Mike Michelle, and she gestures for me to go on. I turn and look out at the hundreds of faces gathered in the hangar-sized hall. Here and there, a flash goes off. I grip the sides of the lectern. I look down at Morgan and the group of Q members seated at the front of the house. My eyes move to Solo's massive presence a few chairs behind. To Beck, smiling that half-smirk smile, her blue eyes burning up at me from the fifth row. I look at my father, hunched down in his chair, watching me intently. He lifts his hand so that it's level with his chest, then extends his pinky and index fingers, making rock and roll devil horns. I smile at him. Then I take a long, deep Dr. Ann breath and close my eyes. To my surprise, it's not a black void that appears behind my eyelids, but a familiar, comforting light. I picture a blackboard, suspended in it. I dip my brush into the surrounding light and begin to paint, erasing the cold blackness bit by bit, replacing it with warm, bright light. I get all the way to the far edge, until there's only a sliver of black remaining. And I reach up with my brush and paint it white. This is Tom Phelan. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Symptoms of Being Human by Jeff Garvin. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2016 by Jeff Garvin. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.